are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 24th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rachel Heyman, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the New School, on driving after class. Anxious times in an American suburb. Also on the program today, the Veterans Administration nominee apparently has an overprescription problem. But to be fair, he was probably drunk. Also on the program today, Rand Paul proudly, independently caves. And Mike Pompeo moves forward. Meanwhile, a Toronto man kills 10 with his van. Motive unclear. And in Washington, Bernie proposes a job guarantee. And the right wing freaks out. Surprise! Republican-Trump tax provision worth $17 billion to millionaires in 2018. Greyhound Bus collaborates with ICE, apparently willingly. Scott Pruitt to unveil a new EPA policy to not use science anymore. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. It is Tuesday. Of course, we actually have, you know, sort of some real, like, politics news over the past 24 hours, right? We have potential, and it's, we'll see what Rand Paul does when it comes to Gina Haspel moving up to CIA director, but he caved yesterday on Mike Pompeo. His explanation was really desperate. I mean, super desperate. Apparently, all that time, and do we have sound of Rand Paul making a big issue of? Okay, we'll get to that later then in the program, because his explanation is. It really does have a feel of like, oh shoot, we should have thought of a plan B before now, because apparently just Trump called him and said, I don't know, we're not going to golf anymore, and he just caved immediately. But he didn't seem to have a plan B as to his explanation as to what it was going to be. We will get to that later in the program. Pompeo, like I say, will move forward now, and undoubtedly in the Senate there is no filibustering anymore of nominees. Unless the coming out of committee, there is no recommendation whatsoever. There will be now because Rand Paul. The VA nominee was supposed to have hearings today. Sonny Jackson, what is it? Is that his name?
Ronnie
Jackson, and apparently.
Sonny Jackson.
Well, Ronnie Sonny Jackson. He likes both. He likes to be called both.
Call him Sonny.
Sonny Ronnie.
Sunny side up.
Sonny
drunk when he's
Ronnie
in his room.
Jackson. Apparently, in addition to having absolutely no experience that would be relevant to running a massive bureaucracy, he also apparently has far too much experience in getting drunk and basically handing out pills.
Boo.
And that's what I liked about it.
Sounds like Dr. Fun.
That is.
Can all the fat vets get that diet pills that I get?
Also, not so uptight about when it comes to diagnosing people. That's the other thing I like about him. We will dig into that in a moment. But And before we get to this clip of Mitt Romney, which is pretty funny, just want to remind you that as the Sam Cedar axiom is it an axiom? I don't think it's an axiom, actually. But the best time to look for people to hire is when you actually don't need to hire anybody. So I'm constantly scouring around for replacements for people who just willy-nilly don't show up on a Monday.
Good luck.
And you missed the icing that we did yesterday.
Of Peterson?
No, icing is a game that I learned from the presidential vetting agency. There's an agency that Trump has, and what they do is they hide a bottle of malt liquor. And if you see it, you have to drink it.
I believe it's Smirnoff Ice.
Smirnoff Ice, yeah. Smirnoff Ice, name. Which is a malt liquor. Exactly,
that's
Smirnoff
awesome.
Ice. So,
any flashbacks of 2008?
Yeah, we did that. I still, I can't quite figure out why people do that. Like, why don't they just leave it on their desk? Why do they actually hide it?
I think Smirnoff wanted to create a game for people to buy their
that
beers.
That seems like a very, very unsophisticated game.
Those
like,
are not beers,
you
by
would
the
have
way.
Never worked in an agency
well, if you
planning
don't
world,
want,
Sam.
If you don't want to find it, you just don't look.
But that's how dumb ideas like this are created to market products. You would have been terrible in that. Like, they would have been like, what if it's like a game? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I'm just saying, come up with a cleverer game.
Here's a screeching halt for another ideation at the agency.
I think the demographic that icing is shooting for is maybe not the cleverest.
Bro,
not
yes,
appreciating
right.
the most clever
games. They're just the ones who would staff the presidential agency in charge of determining the qualities of the qualifications of the other staff.
We're not playing Settlers of Catan here.
I will say this, though. If I was working at a place and they said it's time for an ideation, I think that's when I would probably leave.
That would be the best. Watch your response.
Anyways, aside, my point being.
You want some ideation on this?
I don't want any ideation. My point being, the best time to look for a hire is when you don't need it. And as you know, every business needs great people, unless, of course, you're the White House, in which case,
great in a certain sense.
Ballpark. You need something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, invites them to apply to your job. I have someone in this office who was brought to us via ZipRecruiter. There you go. Okay. Thank you. He just raised his thumb. Yeah. You know. There was honestly, we had, yeah, there you go, Brandon.
Thank you, ZipRecruiter.
Honestly, we had so many qualified people. I met with literally over a dozen people because I'm like, and everybody, there was, we frankly, with all due respect, Brendan, could have hired any of those other ones and just been just as happy.
They would come in and Sam would sit down. Sam would go, let's ideate.
ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for. It identifies people with the right experience, invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. It's true. I mean, I'm speaking from experience. ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive, so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. We're a tiny place here. I could see how that would work awesome if you were a bigger place, too. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. 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 Do it now. Check out the system before you need to make a hire. Believe me, makes total sense. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, so this was a funny clip. Poor Mitt Romney. Poor Mitt Romney. You know, I can't help but be reminded that Mitt Romney reminded all of us that if he had a Latino surname, he'd probably be president by now. But
so true.
So true. I have been completely disadvantaged by my heritage except for the part about my dad being a governor and president of one of the largest car companies in America in history, which would have undoubtedly happened name was Rodriguez.
I would have traded it all in for some Mexican jeans.
There you go. If only I had that, I'd be president now. So Mitt Romney is, of course, running for the Senate seat vacated by Orrin Hatch in Utah. And, of course, it's time for him to be a Utahn again. I remember back when he was a Massachusettser and a masshole, as we used to say, and he would get out in front of those Celtics, and boy, would he cheer. And he has not lost the groove, ladies and gentlemen. Watch him. Here he goes. There he is, back in the day where he would hold up, "I am a Celtic." Now, I get that. Yeah. I actually had a moment when I moved down here where I thought, like, I might become a Yankees fan. That lasted for about 45 minutes. Ooh. But, yeah, no.
But, I mean, look, Bill de Blasio, whatever, this stuff is small. But
right,
he
of
says,
course.
Hey, I'm a Red Sox fan.
Did you guys refer to your own as massholes? Because I remember that from Connecticut. That's what we would call you people.
Oh, yeah. I refer to myself
that's
that
true,
way.
Though.
Totally.
Wow. That's
true. Absolutely.
You got to
wear
it.
You got to own it. All right, here is Mitt Romney. He is taunting. Who is it? Who is he taunting?
Russell Westbrook. Okay. Picked up his fourth foul in the second quarter.
Yeah, which is, you know, I mean, that's four
gotta
fouls.
Got to play by the rules.
Got to play by the rules.
Watch those hands, buddy.
He should have been benched after three. Should have been benched until the second half after three.
That Russell Westbrook plays really rough.
But I here wish, he goes.
Too bad you don't have a dad now, that can clean the slate for you.
Westbrook plays for the Thunder and, you know, obviously probably he's by far the best guy on the team. All right, here is, and so here's Mitt Romney going crazy.
Russell coming back after the
there he goes. Four. Four. Look at, I put the shirt over my.
Four. Four, Russell. Four.
Who let the dogs out?
Hey, Russell.
Who?
Hey, Russell.
And.
Who? Who has four in the third
now,
and the second
if,
quarter?
If Westbrook had wanted to taunt Romney back, he would have gone 49.12%, which is what Mitt Romney got in the second round of voting at the Utah GOP convention. In the first round, he did not get even that, and there were 12 candidates. You needed 60% to get the nomination. He only got 49.12 in the in the second round, which at first I thought, like, oh, okay, well, there was 11 other people. No, but in the second round, it was just him and one other guy. And Mike Kennedy had 50.88%. So I think Mitt Romney's probably going to win this primary in Utah. Although, in I guess Kennedy is like a Trumpista. And, Romney is, well, I don't know. He's attempting to run as not. It would be so great to see Mitt Romney lose that primary in Utah that I almost, like, I've like contemplated leaving New York, moving to Utah, becoming a Utahian citizen and a Republican just to vote against him in that
doing
primary.
Pro bono consulting for the other guy. Like, yeah, exactly. I like it, but it's not quite racist enough. We need to beat Mitt.
Right.
We're helping him design ads. Like, where's the border wall?
And here's the
thing.
You're
not hitting your point.
Mitt Romney is going to go into, and he's going to pick one thing to disagree with Donald Trump on. And the rest is just going to be pure Republican pablum, the same stuff that Trump is pushing. And he is going to have the exact same profile as all these other people who enable Donald Trump, but pretend that they have a problem with him. And that's the way he's behaved, really, since Trump invited him to have dinner and maybe become Secretary of State.
Hello, this is Mitt Romney.
So good luck, Mitt. Good luck. All right, we're going to take a quick break when we come back. One other thing I wanted to mention, just briefly. Longtime listener to this program, Teacher Lauren, her mom has been diagnosed with a couple of severe diseases, and she can't see, which has prevented her from working or driving. She set up a GoFundMe. We will put that on the site and in the podcast. If you if you can spare even a buck or two, head over there, and she could use the help because you know, people who are not working need some food and housing. So just check it out. All right, quick break. When we come back, Rachel Hyman, on Driving After Class, Anxious Times in American Suburbs. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Rachel Hyman. She is an associate professor of anthropology at the New School and author of Driving After Class, Anxious Times in an American Suburb. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, okay, you did an ethnographic study of a, an anonymous town, which you called Danboro, was it right? But it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not really Danboro, but it's in New Jersey. And so, all right, just give us a sense of the first, just sort of from a methodological standpoint. What did you actually do in terms of the research?
So, in anthropology, when we use the term ethnography, a lot of fields talk about ethnography. In anthropology, it means really spending significant, dedicated time in everyday life in a place. It could be a town. It could be in a company. It could be in a city. But really to understand in the nuances and subtleties of everyday life, the kinds of things that I think you can only scratch on the surface if you're going to just do interviews or survey data. And so for me, I really moved to this town, or nearby. I couldn't afford to live in the town, and lived there for almost 19 months, being a part of everyday life. And this included spending time, you know, after school with kids and families in their homes. It meant, you know, driving around town with kids, going to the mall, going to a lot of meetings at night, things of the planning board, the zoning board, Board of Education meetings, really just trying to understand life in the way that people who are living there experience it. I also worked for one family who kind of doubled as a babysitter and doing research. I called it an ethnographic babysitter, where I could really be in the kind of intimate aspects of life in a way that I think are tricky if you're just kind of popping in and hanging out for an afternoon. So really be there when kids are coming home from school, dinner's being made, driving them around town, having conversations in the car in the way that parents might do. But as a researcher,
and they knew. I mean, you didn't. They knew that you were not just a babysitter, right? I mean, they knew that you were doing research as well.
Oh yes. Well, I first got the job just as a babysitter, getting a little extra money to fund my research. In anthropology, a lot of the grants are written assuming that you are just paying for a plane ticket to Nepal and don't need that much to live on day to day. And obviously the cost of doing research in New Jersey is significantly more. So initially, actually, for that one aspect, I really just was getting a job to get extra money because I had worked as a summer camp counselor and with youth in a lot of jobs. And so, but while I was there, I started to realize that this, there was so much I was seeing that was really relevant for the questions I was exploring. And then I asked the parents if I could then use my time there as part of my research, both the observations that I would go home and write down at the end of the day, but also do formal interviews with them and with their children. And so they did agree. And for everyone else, too, all the kids and parents that were involved, we went through, you know, a consent process, a standard institutional review board consent process. But for public meetings, you know, public meetings are public meetings.
Right.
So I could go, you know, and tape a zoning board meeting and use that, or a public any kind of public thing in town hall. So for those, yeah, I was just there taping, not always, you know, in the same way that journalists are sitting next to me in the room.
Okay. So, all right. So the people that you were studying essentially and observing had come from Brooklyn, mostly in the 70s and the 80s. And so give us a sense of like what the expectations or the reasons why people were moving to the suburbs. And then we can get into, I guess, you know, sort of how those expectations were or were not met.
Yeah, so I think I purposely chose this particular kind of people because I think there's been so much written about baby boomers, but baby boomers who were growing up in the suburbs in the post-war period. And there's very little looking at the baby boomers who were not, who were particularly, you know, white baby boomers who were still living in cities at the time during white flight. And we're seeing representations of their generation that they were not a part of. They weren't living in suburban homes. They weren't having that kind of model of success in their everyday life. And so I think for a lot of people who grew up that way, I think even though they loved cities, they also had a sense that to be successful in America and to have made it, especially if you're a kid of immigrant parents, the way to succeed in America was to get a job where you could earn enough money and to buy a house in the suburbs. And so I think for this generation, they saw this ideal that supposedly their generation was growing up in, and they weren't. And I think there was a mix. I think a lot of people really loved the cities. I think there was a disinvestment in cities at the time. I think there are some people who would have been happy to raise their children in the cities in the way that they were, but they felt, you know, disinvestment in the school systems. Also, you know, some racial anxieties about changes in the city, demographics, who was living nearby. But also, I think the really strong sense, you know, that I think people of color, working class, all people have a sense that you're supposed to get a house in the suburbs if you succeed. So I think for those reasons, you know, for a variety of reasons, whether it was having more space, having a lawn, having better public schools, but also for some that this is what you were supposed to do. And so I think for many people, you know, got out there and got settled in, some of whom it lived up to their expectations and they were thrilled. Some people felt a little bit duped by the idea that this is what they were supposed to do to be successful.
And okay, so let's get into the dynamic that you discuss around the potential that a family would put a gate in front of their house, because this ends up sort of like exposing sort of this dynamic, I guess, that the consciousness of people where they were on essentially a totem pole, if you will.
Yeah. So this is a critical part of the book that I'm trying to show. And I think we hear about this in places like in China, India, that there's a kind of old middle class and a new middle class. Right. And I think for these people who moved out to what I call town, I call Danboro in the 70s and 80s, they were sort of, you know, living in modest homes by American standards, a standard 70s colonial style home. But there were a lot of changes in the town that were happening around the country in the late 80s, but particularly in the 90s, when all of a sudden, you know, what we disdainfully call McMansions, big homes are going up everywhere. Schools are overburdened and overflowing. The infrastructure can't keep up, even road maintenance. Everyone all of a sudden is starting to be stuck in traffic. But at the same time, right across from their development are these houses and this change in the town that represent the changes in the middle class. Not to say that everything was just all equal when people moved in the 60s and 70s, but in the same way around the country, there was a really dramatic growth in class disparities happening across the class spectrum. There really was this great divide growing within the middle class as well. And so people were really kind of confronting in their town, in their schools, I think a sense that somehow they were no longer securely in the middle or even questioning what the middleness was, and also feeling a sense that actually now to be successful, you now had to be in one of those bigger houses. You couldn't just be kind of settled, you know, paying your mortgage as you could afford, paying for what you afford. You had to kind of scale up in a way that wasn't accessible. And so there was, you know, this is a town that I think people felt a kind of real commitment to, you know, having open lawns, no gated communities, public schools, and the classic post-war ideal of what suburban life was. But at the same time, as we know around the country, gates and gated communities were popping up everywhere, but not in towns like this. These are still towns where you could, you know, walk onto your neighbor's yard. And so in the time that I was there, the first person who wanted to put up a gate in front of their house came up in a zoning board meeting. Now, people had asked for gates before, but normally, or fences, but they were really people who were on a main road, and they were concerned that their kids would, you know, run out to main road. So those kind of fences were allowed. But this was somebody who really just wanted to put a gate at the end of their driveway. It wasn't really a security gate. It wasn't connected to a whole compound. You could walk right around it. They wanted it to be the scale of their house, which, you know, the zoning board allowed gates that are up to 3 feet in this town, which is kind of classic in most places around the country. It was built, you know, on the model of the picket fence. You might mark your property, but you could still see over. Frederick Long Olmsted, who designed Central Park, was a great American landscaper. He kind of didn't want us to be like England or other places that really marked the divide. It kind of liked this illusion of a democratic landscape, that one big lawn flowing through the country. Now, we know, of course, people still have property, but there was this idea that you could still at least see over. But we were in a moment in the 90s around the country where that ideal, that kind of liberal ideal of land use was giving way to a kind of neoliberal moment in which people were clearly marking their property, kind of wanting to keep people out, not playing the game that everybody could be on my lawn, even though I don't want them there. And that's a very different way of thinking about neighborliness. And so for people who are seeing this gate go up, you know, I went to a zoning bar gate where nobody mentioned class. Nobody mentioned the class changes in town. And yet, you know, it was clear to me that what was going on in this moment wasn't just concern about, you know, this big gate. Did you really need it for security? But really about what does it mean to have somebody, you know, on a cul-de-sac putting up a gate to mark their property in a place that we don't do that. And so I saw that as really a moment in which really reflected and threw into relief what those class changes were and what they meant and what they really represented about where we were going as a country in thinking about the marking of property. And so I do think for people in their neighborhoods, it really was this sense, again, a marking of all of a sudden, are they trying to keep me out? Because people who often wanted gates, and even in this argument, was kind of hinting at racial anxieties and other things. But I think people felt like, no, wait, they're trying to keep us out. You know, me who looks like them, I'm just a little bit lower down the rung, class rung, but all of a sudden I'm the person who they don't want there.
Do you think people had that consciousness? I mean, how explicit was that consciousness? I mean, you said no one mentioned class, but I mean, how explicit was that consciousness that that this was an issue of money, right? I mean, because it's interesting, yeah. You know, this reminds me of, I spoke to, it was actually Chris Hayes who wrote a piece about going to Davos and the notion of fractal inequality, where apparently the billionaires get to go to the top floor and they get a special like card that allows them to go into, you know, meetings on the top floor, and the 100 millionaires are not allowed to get up there, and they're upset about it, and they're walking around feeling dejected on some level. There's some quality to this about this, right? Like that it really is, there's a fractal inequality going on.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what was interesting, and I think I get into in the book, is a kind of doing a very close linguistic analysis of this debate, which, you know, I think that even the arguments, how they start getting to be picked apart, You know, they start out saying they need it for security, and then the zoning board starts to pick it apart and say, well, you know, you can walk around it. You know, why do you need it in our town that's incredibly safe? And then they start to, you know, get into the aesthetics. Well, the owner wants something that matches the scale of their house. But when they, when you look at this image of the aesthetics, it really looks, it had a kind of crown. So all of a sudden people start joking like, oh, they need this regal thing to let people know not to drive in their property. So they really start to joke and calling it, you know, just all about the aesthetics. And so what happens is, though, the person in the argument starts to say, like, look, of course, my owner, they want to have something that matches the scale of the house and the aesthetics of house. If they bid something, built something at 3 feet, which is what the zoning board allows, it's going to look like a stockade fence. Now, in that moment, there really was almost a hush in the room, because essentially what they were saying is what this town has always valued and the height that they prefer, we think looks like a stockade, you know, this kind of militaristic, simplistic thing. So what happened was there's all these discussions about aesthetics, about security, that really felt, and then really mocking at the end by the zoning board, sidebar comments of people joking about the owners in the audience, that felt, yeah, like the kind of ways in which, exactly saying that people probably milling the floor at Davos, the millionaires, were probably like, oh, you know, those billionaires on the top floor, you know, kind of making fun of things about them that may have just been about how they're dressed or how they talked. But in that joking and in that speech, you know, felt like a real sense about the way that these people were acting. And so I can't really say what was going on in people's heads, you know, in that moment. I didn't do an interview right then and there because it was something that happened. I just had my recorder on. I was going to zoning board meetings and something felt really interesting. And it wasn't actually till a little bit later that I went back and thought, wow, there's something really interesting here. But I called the zoning board meeting, the zoning board office several years later to just kind of follow up when I was publishing the book to say, you know, has anyone, you know, do people build, you know, I have a question about 6 foot high, you know, gates in the front of people's property. And right away, she was like, hold on, like passing me off to someone else and got me to someone else. And was like, we don't allow them. And I was like, I'm not calling as a resident asking. I'm actually just a researcher who was here years ago and I'm finishing a book. And she was like, oh, and she rattled off the property. I mean, right away, everybody remembered years later. This particular case, and kind of as if they had kind of held at bay an approach to land use and community that could have crept in. But what I really, yeah.
Sorry. What was there? Did you have a sense of any other fallout from that? Or was that just something that, you know, was more deeply ingrained in the minds of the people who worked in the town hall? Or was there sort of a, Did any of that resonate with the folks at that meeting or the rest of the town in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think it resonated, you know, very powerfully, obviously, for people in the room. You know, these are the kind of meetings that only people who have to be there go, you know, they drag on. So it wasn't a huge crowd that were there for some other things. But I do think, though, the message was definitely sent to people who were coming to buy that if they had this in mind, this was not going to be the town. And there were towns, you know, next door that allowed 6 foot high gates. So I think they were kind of marking themselves. But what I try to talk about in the book, though, is that I think why this to me was a really interesting moment is that on the one hand, you have this encroachment of these kind of neoliberal approaches to land use, these changes that are going on in a town that when you drive through it, it looks like it could be from 1964, if you don't, you know, in terms of its layout, in terms of its whole aesthetic, except for these new homes. And a lot of things that were happening in the town were not trying to kind of protect that old ideal. So I think I'm trying to say that in the book that on the one hand, people were trying to keep gates out, but yet in whole other kinds of ways, there was still a lot of gating going on in the town in terms of who would be in the schools and not in the schools, things like that. So I think there's very kind of contradictory impulses of wanting a different kind of way of life at the same time. That was more what they moved there for. At the same time, really sort of doing their own internal gating with their kids, buffering up their kids, extra tutors, getting the SUV to feel safer, the kind of shoring up that is its own form of gating around your kids, around your own family to succeed. When in fact, you know, instead of turning to these bigger questions about what the state is or isn't doing to help you individually.
Well, can you talk more about that? Because on some level, you know, as you, you know, as you describe the idea of, and I guess we're getting into this notion of rugged entitlement to a certain extent, and I want you to speak to that, but the also to those other forms of gating and what they're, I mean, because that could be seen as a response, right? I mean, obviously it's not a direct response, but the idea that we are being approached by, or I'm being made more conscious that we haven't quite achieved what I thought maybe we had achieved. And there's another thing to achieve that, in fact, some people want to keep me from by gating them out. That means that that I've got to work even harder or have my my offspring work even harder. I mean, can you start to talk about those ways that the gating happened?
Yeah, so I think, you know, part of what I'm really trying to do in the book is just that. And I think I used the title, right, Driving After Class, but also introduce this phrase, rugged entitlement, which I think to me captures this really contradictory moment in which people are in some sense, really grappling with in this moment and continue now. And this idea that on the one hand, we have this idea that you individually succeed, meritocracy, like you work hard and you get to move up the class chain, you get to have whatever the ideals are of success. And in this moment, right, the suburban house. And that, you know, if you work hard, you get that, right? And we know, though, that, you know, people work very hard, but certain kinds of people are given an extraordinary amount of support and leg up to do that. And some of that's just privileges of, say, being white that makes it easier, but also extraordinary amount of government support in the post-war period to subsidize housing, free college, a whole slew of things that enabled a huge group of people to enter into the middle class. Now, the people I'm writing about in this book, though, they're coming after that, where actually a lot of these supports are being undermined. But people still have a sense of entitlement to the entitlements that people were given, right? That I, you know, or at least entitlement to the things that people got through entitlements, right? But at the same time, you know, we have this ideal of the rugged individual, which we know from historians was really a kind of an illusion and a myth created that the people were, you know, were incredibly rugged and doing things that they headed out west. And the other time, if it wasn't for the U.S. military that took land from Native Americans and gave it to people, that helped protect people, that provided extraordinary amount of support and huge networks within families, communities to survive, you know, people don't do things on their own. And in fact, they succeed much better and have in this country with extraordinary amount of support from the state. So I think this concept is trying to say, you know, on the one hand, we have this myth of the rugged individual. On the other hand, right now we're in this point in which we're a lot closer to those earlier historic moments when people had not as much support to succeed. But I'm calling it rugged entitlement because there was a huge period of real entitlement that certain groups of people, you know, that now white or became white, were given to get that leg up. So what do we mean when people have an expectation for something that there's no structural support and state support underneath it, right? And now, so what happens in that moment? And so for me, I think these kinds of conditions that people are in is to say, okay, the way we think and have been trained in the U.S. is to say, well, the way to succeed is to help make sure my own kid gets into school. So if there's going to be a question about the school, I'm going to really think about what's in the best interest of my child, maybe at the expense of other children. Or I'm going to have this gate on my property, regardless of what that means for the neighbors nearby. Or I'm going to drive an SUV. During those years, they were three times more likely to kill someone in an accident than if you drove a little Toyota. But I'm still going to drive this because I feel safer in that. And so all these modes of driving after class that are kind of, whether it's extra SAT tutors you know, fighting a battle to, you know, make sure your kid gets the right spot in the right school, or using different kinds of resources and consultants to help you in a way that other people can't afford, that those are modes of gating. Those are modes of sort of putting a sort of protection. But in the same way, when you gate your property, you don't really secure your property. And it's a thing that might make you feel better. But most of the time, these aren't real secure compounds. I feel like it's a kind of metaphor I feel like the SUV is also kind of a metaphor of buying or doing something that makes you feel secure, that doesn't always necessarily actually make you more secure and surely often may undermine your neighbor's security. And so I really see it as a kind of almost kind of not, maybe not intentional divide, you know, divide and conquer, but it seems that if you have all kinds of people from all different kinds of class and race positions in a regional school district that's underfunded, where developers are getting to build all they want and never have to put in a dime towards new schools, or developer, you know, and then the individual homeowners have to flip the bill. And so I think we're in a moment now in which, you know, since this time where I think people are starting to realize, like, wait a minute, why are we fighting with each other over the scraps, over these few spots, when in fact we're all collectively, you know, in a position of that we shouldn't really be in, and to sort of demand, put a demand, whether it's our local governments, our state governments, federal governments, to think about, you know, where we are in the question of what entitlements are and what they should be. To help support people's lives. So I think there's a kind of scramble rat race thing that's escalated exponentially, put extraordinary stress on kids, on families. And I think, how do we somehow step out of that rat race to try to just secure our own family, our own children, and really think about that collective good that gets us to something where a broader swath of people can have a kind of security.
Do you think, to what extent, because, I mean, you're basically telling a story of insecurity and the different sort of, I guess, mm-hmm. mechanisms in which people you observed were using to enhance their sense of security. And it, ultimately, it was quixotic in a way. But was this function, was this insecurity, was it distinct from... So clearly they leave Brooklyn and the urban environment for the security that comes from, or the imagined security that comes from the suburbs. Was this a story of like you can run but you can't hide from, you know, what's going on? Was it just a function of like the dynamic that is driving this insecurity? Is pervasive? Was it unique to the suburb, as far as you could tell? Obviously, you know, the scope of your study, you know, you weren't comparing two places, but mm-hmm. But I mean, could you get a sense of where that insecurity lived, I guess?
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, and that's it's a great question and a tricky question. And I think that I was trying to always, you know, and I always did struggle with the question of some things that, you know, parents have been anxious about for a long time, their kids succeeding and wanting to do well. How is it different now than in other moments?
Well, that, you know, was actually my next question too, because
okay.
because, you know, that I was in one instance I'm talking about sort of like spatially or geographically in terms of context, but also I would also say temporally too, because yeah. I mean, you're talking about the 90s in some respects, and maybe better, maybe worse, in fact, than that dynamic now. Of course, now those people stay in Brooklyn. Right. And they don't go to the suburbs, yeah. because things have almost yeah. flipped in some way. Yeah. Yeah. But speak to both the spatial, yeah. I guess, and the temporal, element here.
Yeah. No. So I think spatially, I think, like you said, I wasn't doing a comparative study. And I do think these things were happening more broadly. And I think they also happened very diversely within a space. There's some people that felt secure. They were fine. They had never overmortgaged and, you know, we're going to ride it out. But I do think, though, that I purposely picked this kind of space intentionally because I wanted to bring into view the kinds of places that people weren't studying in the 90s to think about the class changes. They were looking at, you know, gentrification in cities and looking at gated communities, right? These kinds of spaces that in some ways were very iconic of, you know, neoliberal approaches in those eras. And so part of me wanted to say, okay, what does it mean to go to a place that we think we know, a kind of space that may seem very familiar. Like, why would you go to this kind of suburb? They've been studied endlessly since, you know, the 50s. Because I wanted us to figure out how to see these changes in a way that isn't thrown into relief, to see them in these very subtle ways in people's everyday lives and in their towns and their habits and their fears, and the ways they move through town, what provokes them when they drive down and see a house knocked down and a big one built in its place. So I wanted us to theorize that moment in time from a place we think we know, and to sort of better understand these changes. So I think in that sense, spatially, I don't know comparatively, but I do think, at least my experience from people reading the book and feedback I've gotten or teaching it over the years, is that, you know, it isn't just kids who grew up in suburbs in those moments that see something that really resonates. They feel those pressures they were feeling as kids, you know, growing up in the city at that time, that kind of anxiousness. And so I do think some of those things may resonate spatially. And I think in terms of temporally, I mean, that too, you know, I think was embedded in my choice of the place. I talk about sort of notions of kind of residual aspects of other historical moments. So some people say, well, you know, in your book, you talk about people trying to keep the carpet clean. Well, my grandmother in Brooklyn, like, had plastic on her couch. So, you know, people have always been trying to do those things. And I guess my question is, or my thinking is, how do we make sense of each historical moment and distill what might be familiar practices, like asking someone to, you know, in this case, take their shoes off to keep white carpet clean. But how do those things matter in different moments? What's at stake? And then what are the ultimate effects of those kinds of practices, right? And so there were messy racialized school board debates, you know, in Brooklyn in the 70s. And they're happening, you know, all over the suburbs in the 90s and continue to this day. But what are the stakes in that moment when the kinds of broader entitlements and conditions are really different for the kids and the families that are going to those schools, and the global economy and the possibilities? So it's a tricky question of, is somebody more anxious in another moment? But I think for me, the question is, what are the effects? What happens with those practices? How do they shape the spaces? How do they shape the kids? And what then becomes a new normal in a way that I think, you know, we can look back in different historical moments and say, okay, something that we take for granted now would not be considered normal, or something is really the same in our approach to kids and family and neighborhoods. So I think it's, yeah, I mean, these are great questions and they're really tricky. And I think I'm trying to also just have, you know, people who read the book, and especially for, you know, really wrote it to be taught and try, you know, even first year students, to, what does it mean to also just learn how to see class and class in these spaces and think about how some little thing we might not do that we might not think is classed, and that may have kinds of class effects or have kind of effects about the racial politics of class or the spatial politics of class in our everyday lives. What does it mean to look through our lives through that kind of a lens? So I think in that sense, too, it was both kind of spatially and historically, but also just as a kind of way of seeing, in a way that I think in this country we, you know, have never been really good about just talking about class and thinking about class and acknowledging class and really kind of interrogating it in that way.
How homogenous racially was Danbro?
It was more homogenous when people moved there. I'd say, you know, it was a mix of, you know, Italian, Jewish, some Irish, was more the majority when people moved, but it got more diverse by the time the 90s came. I mean, you know, big sort of, you know, increasing people moving out, you know, also from the city or directly in from parts of Asia, India. But, you know, and it's definitely making a racial change. But I do think that, and those were sort of real issues playing out. I think, though, I tried not to mark people by their ethnicity in the book, because I feel like in the U.S., the minute we hear racial or ethnic things, we kind of override sometimes how do we think about class. Because if you sit down now with some family there that you know, are Indian American, whether or they're Italian American, some of these things, they might have different ways of approaching and different family traditions. But, you know, they start to sound very similar when it comes to some of these kinds of questions. And I think that's, you know, always been the kind of Americanization and suburbanization mode that, you know, I think there's been lots of books how, you know, Jews and Italians, you know, were separate communities, separate turfs in Brooklyn. And then they go out to the suburbs and they start to seem very alike. In ways that they were not seen in a way of what values are or where they fall on different kinds of issues in terms of neighborhoods and schools. So I do think there's, I think a broader comment I want to make, not to take away from other forms of diversity, but to show how powerfully the, you know, suburban ideal and success model and ways of thinking about how we share or don't share, or who we are trying to sort of look out for, or who we don't look out for, that those are sort of broader ideological and discursive problems that I think no matter how much people want to work against that, and there are plenty of people in the town who were trying to work against that, you are kind of working against really the normative grain in some communities like this, even if there are, you know, plenty of sort of people who ideologically, politically, you know, wish that the town approached these things differently. You know, I think it does speak to the sort of broader.
Let me ask you this. I mean, lastly, if have you gone back to the town and have you seen any, I guess, sort of tangible differences that would indicate the insecurity? You know, would indicate the sort of the responses to this insecurity and to that dynamic of, I guess, broadly speaking, privatization that, you know, was starting to sort of filter in as people were, you know, feeling themselves to be more in competition with each other?
Well, I think I see both. I mean, on the one hand, there's, you know, the chapter in the book about the high school redistricting debates that were really kind of racialized, messy, you know, the sense that the world would fall apart if my kids moved from one school to another. And, you know, there had been parts of the district that already were zoned for different schools that had a sense that, you know, if you move into a broader district, that's not just your town, like they may rezone you. Other people really didn't have that sense. I felt like they owned their school and they were not willing to kind of be part of the larger regional district. But, you know, since then, you know, there's been a lot of redistricting. So people in a lot of these towns are now all going to different schools. And that's become a kind of normative idea that you live in. I mean, not that people don't fight them, but I think the idea that you may move into one town and the name of your school might be a different one because you're just in a really big district that, you know, had a lot of development and kids have to be moved around. So that, you know, I think is a different kind of change that people wouldn't have anticipated then. On the other hand, yeah, there are, I think, you know, people who, the town started actually to deal with property tax, which, you know, New Jersey is a huge question of people being able to afford to stay and also attracting businesses. So they started actually a shop local program in the town that is about, which is this complex, I'm actually sort of writing a piece on it now, but is this kind of interesting way that at first sounds like this great idea, like you swipe a card and you, if you shop at a restaurant, something in the town, you get a discount on your property taxes. But then as you start to sort of dive into it deeply, you realize that, well, there's a private company that is running this swipe card system. They make more money every time someone swipes. And so then, you know, are you supporting local businesses that you get the tax base back? Sometimes, you know, is a Wegmans a local business? And even who gets that discount, if it's only going to property taxes, then only homeowners are getting it, not renters. So, you know, and then you start to realize it's maybe being used more for marketing purposes, like to recruit businesses in town to say, look, you know, these are all the ways that we support you. You know, if you come to our town, we're going to make sure people in our town actually shop here. When in fact, it's not having that huge effect because the local businesses are the ones paying it. It's almost like an added sales tax. So it's become this kind of interesting, again, idea to like use this business model that you see credit card companies doing as a way to govern. And then in a way, when it starts playing out, it actually is not, you know, people who can have more, you know, spending power then get more discounts. So in some sense, are you exacerbating some of these divides? And you're pulling money from towns. If you're a town that has more money, is a bit more elite than some of your neighbors, now your people aren't going to shop at the, you know, dry cleaners across the street. They're going to shop in your own town. So it almost to me feels like at first glance sounds like, oh, shop local, you know, but then you start to dive in and you realize it's almost another form of gating, of keeping the dollars in, supporting, and then actually distribute them to people that maybe aren't the ones that need them the most. So it's, I mean, it doesn't sort of completely map out that way, but I think it's kind of interesting current moment of that kind of tension around, you know, doing something good to in governance, but having it go through a kind of certain kind of privatized logic and that don't get redistributed evenly.
It's a fascinating study, Driving After Class, Anxious Times in an American Suburb. Rachel Hyman, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We will put a link to the book on our site.
Great. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you. All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. We cannot do it without you. You can head over to jointhemajorityreport.com to support the program. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. Thank you. Every day. And if you can't afford to become a member, as always, send us an email, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Wait 17 weeks until I get to your email, and then we will hook you up. majorityreporters@gmail.com. And also, don't forget, you have six more days to get your Just Coffee 30% off discount at Just Coffee. This month, April, is the month for that 30% discount. Free shipping, folks. So if you've ever wanted to try justcoffee.coop, this is the time to try it. You don't even need a coupon code. Just go ahead and head over there. Also, it is Tuesday. Therefore, it is TMBS Day.
Oh, Michael, I like that. Bastille Day.
I didn't say Bastille Day. I said Tuesday.
I said, you said TMBS Day, right?
Right.
I said like Bastille Day. It's a little bit of a joke.
Both has day at the end.
Right, exactly. Right. It was a little bit of a stretch.
April both Fool's some, Day.
Well, this is a little Arbor bit more Day. Left wing. Oh, Arbor Day I like too. Arbor Day is very nice. Would you like Tuba to know Shvat. The guests? Would you like to know the guests tonight?
Yeah, I guess so.
Oh no, you ruined it. Forget it. You okay. Actually you're in violation right, folks, of our contract right now. Swine. Tonight, H Bomber Guy on right wing YouTube and how it came to be. And then Corey Pines in studio, we're talking about his new book, Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley.
That's on TMBS tonight. And, of course, head over to Jamie's Patreon account at patreon.com/JamiePeck. Or you can check out Antifada, her podcast.
Yeah, I'm sort of encouraging people to go to the Antifada right now. So
forget what I said about the Patreon. Go to what is the website?
Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Oh, okay. There you go.
And we've got one coming, I think, tomorrow. We talk with our friend Asher Dupuis Spencer of Verso Books about a lot of the issues that we brought up on the show last week relating to electoral politics, social movements, and what the left's strategy should be right now.
All right, we got to take a quick break. Head into the fun app. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.
He said